Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, May 4th, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. Now, we all know that the weekly magazine is a weekly magazine, except when it's not a weekly magazine, and that's the situation we're in right now. The issue in front of me was dated for April 27th, last week, and it's also dated May 4th, so I got to get two shows out of this puppy. And last week I read the regular stuff, and this week I'll read the unregular stuff, or irregular, is that the word? Anyway, here we go. We'll start in a section called News, and I got a bunch of articles. The first one: after dozens ran for president, Peru's voters head to runoff. With no clear front-runner in Peru's crowded presidential elections, voters in the South American nation will likely need to return to the polls for a June 7th runoff. Some 35 candidates had vied for the first election, held in early April. The most likely scenario for June is a face-off between two right-wing options. Former presidential candidate and congressional leader Keiko Fujimori has risen to the top spot, albeit with a support of about 14%, according to polls released in early April. Former Lima mayor Rafael Lopez Aliaga, known across Peru as Porky for his resemblance to the cartoon character, has fallen from his one-time lead to second or even third behind conservative former comedian Carlos Alvarez. Voters, like many across Latin America, are focused on crime and restoring order, analysts say. And many Peruvians say the proposals made by presidential candidates are unbelievable at best. The candidates come out with proposals that seem designed to make them look tougher than the rest, but I'm not hearing anything I'm confident will change the very bad situation we are living and working in, says Jose Quispe, a bus depot and route manager for Santa Catalina Transportation, a Lima-based private transit company that runs 220 buses with 300 drivers. For more than a year, Mr. Quispe's company has come under relentless extortion pressures from gangs. The message is, you pay or you die, and we have learned that they are not kidding around, says Mr. Quispe, as he shifts the fingers of one hand from making the sign for money to forming a pistol that he points at his head. Still, some officials and law enforcement experts point out that statistically, Peru is not the crime-ridden danger that newscasts present. There's been a surge in certain kinds of violent crime, in particular extortion, which is carried out largely in working-class neighborhoods. There were an estimated 30% more cases of extortion reported in the first 8 months of 2025 compared with the same period in 2024. But Peru's crime rates pale in comparison to some regional neighbors. And that was written by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer. Our next one is, Anthropic's new Mythos AI tool signals a new era. The AI company Anthropic shared in April that its most advanced model to date, Claude Mythos Preview, not only had found thousands of severe vulnerabilities in common operating systems that humans had missed, but also had devised sophisticated ways to exploit those gaps. The software was so powerful, the San Francisco-based company said that it would not release it publicly, but rather, for the moment, would make it available to a newly formed consortium of some 40 key tech companies that could fix the vulnerabilities Mythos found. If what Anthropic has claimed about Mythos is true, it reflects an intense new phase of the long-standing arms race between hackers and cybersecurity firms. This is kind of the beginning of the full-scale reckoning of the cyber risk posed by AIs, said Mantas Mazika, research scientist at the Center for AI Safety, a nonprofit that advocates for standards to manage risks like misinformation, weaponization, and existential threats. The twist is that this time it's the cybersecurity community that might have gained a step on the hackers. I view this as an opportunity to get ahead of the bad guys, says V.S. Subramanian, a computer scientist at Northwestern University. We have this capability now to identify the vulnerabilities that might exist in a system. Anthropic built Mythos as a cutting-edge general-purpose AI model. But what Anthropic found was that it had made a big leap in its ability to detect software bugs and, more importantly, how to use those bugs, sometimes in tandem, to attack systems. The company claims it found severe vulnerabilities in every major operating system and web browser, some of which had gone undetected for years. AI models have reached a level of coding capability where they can surpass all but the most skilled humans at finding and exploiting software vulnerabilities, the company warned. Part of Mythos' advantage over humans is the speed at which it can operate. To find software bugs, most major technology companies follow a cycle. They hire professionals who find a vulnerability in the system and figure out how to exploit it. Then those professionals alert the company, which figures out how to, quote-unquote, patch it. Typically, that process takes months. What we're basically seeing these AI systems do now, if everything that they are saying in this announcement is accurate, is that time is compressed significantly, says Ali Mellon, an AI security operations analyst in Boston. The time between anyone, not just a white hat hacker, but also a black hat hacker, or a nation state or a cyber criminal gang, being able to identify and exploit those vulnerabilities is incredibly small. Anthropic says it will not widely release this version to the public in an effort to keep it out of the hands of hackers. Dr. Mellon calls Anthropic's approach a very positive step and exactly what's needed in the short term. Down the road, though, it's a different conversation, she says. We need to rethink the way that we are approaching the patching process and system. That was a joint venture by Laurent Belsey and Caitlin Babcock, and they're both staff writers. Our next one, Massachusetts Ford's social media ban. Massachusetts advanced a bill on April 8th aiming at restricting social media for teens. The legislation, which passed in the Commonwealth's House of Representatives 129-25, would be one of the strictest social media bans in the United States. The proposed law bans cell phones in schools, prohibits children younger than age 14 from using social media, and requires parental consent for 14 and 15-year-olds seeking to open accounts. It still needs approval from the Massachusetts Senate and governor. Similar laws in Florida and Ohio have faced First Amendment challenges in court. Lawmakers in California have mulled a stricter ban for children under age 16. Internationally, countries including Australia, Greece, France, and the United Kingdom have enacted or proposed legislation limiting minors' access to social media. In the U.S., states such as Massachusetts are pushing for strict guidelines following major lawsuits against Meta and YouTube. A Los Angeles jury found that the online platforms were, in fact, liable for their addictive design that has been marketed to minors. That was written by staff, but they don't tell who on the staff wrote it. And our next one, with right-wing loss, Hungarian election reverberates globally. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has ruled his country for 16 years, often with what critics felt was the clenched fist of autocracy. He lost his election April 12th in a political rout that is reverberating across the globe. His opponent's party, formed only 2 years ago, was on course for a two-thirds majority, strong enough even to amend the constitution. Mr. Orbán was an admitted hero and trailblazer for resurgent right-wing politicians from Finland to Germany. He was held up by U.S. President Donald Trump's administration as a model of what Europe could and should be. And he was obstructor-in-chief for the European Union, Russia's most loyal friend, a vetoer of all things pro-Ukrainian, and a standard bearer for those who feel the EU is perpetually undermining the sovereignty of its member nations. Now he has been ousted in a defeat far more comprehensive than the polls or pundits imagined possible. The opposition Tisza party of Peter Magyar was headed for 138 seats in parliament. Mr. Orban's Fitz party was on track for 55, and the far-right Our Homeland party is set for 6. The election brought out a record number of voters, with Hungary's youth appearing to play a pivotal role. High inflation and a stagnant economy has forced many to look abroad for jobs. But 16 years of what Mr. Orban himself said was an increasingly liberal democracy also appeared to have taken a toll. Some revelers on election night couldn't quite grasp that they were now able to express themselves openly. Chants of Europe and Russians go home could be heard among the crowds, from squares to teeming metro stations. In a victory speech, Mr. Magyar declared that Hungarians had said yes to Europe. Certainly, András Széchenyi did. The mathematician and university professor said the result was not just an amazing evening for all Hungarians, but also a new day for Europe. "It will mean a shift in the Russian influence in European politics," he said from an election watch party. "It's a shift in power and a shift in the direction of unity of the European Union." Numerous European leaders agreed, with British Prime Minister Keir Starmer calling it an historic moment for European democracy. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky similarly hailed Mr. Magyar's win in a post on the social platform X, calling it a victory for a constructive approach. Mr. Orban had made Ukraine a centerpiece of his campaign, arguing that the war was not in Hungary's interests. In the EU, Mr. Orban had repeatedly stalled or blocked efforts to help Ukraine. For Mr. Orban's supporters, the results suggest that perhaps Hungary was not the bulwark of far-right politics that they had hoped it was. Speaking at an election night rally for Fidesz, a man who shared only his first name, Bálint, said, "I am disappointed because I thought we were doing better." To him, Hungary was a beacon for a Europe that had lost its way. Fidesz was against the migrants. They were against woke and a liberal nonsense. "We are the last bastion of this Christian democratic thinking in Europe, and we thought that the future of Europe is not based on Brussels, the EU thinking," he added. "We thought that Europe was based on the strong nations." Mr. Orban accepted the result early, calling Mr. Magyar to concede by 9:30 p.m. local time. He called the result of the election clear and painful, but vowed to fight on. "We never give up. This is one thing people know about us. We never give up." And that was written by Mark Sappenfield, who is a staff writer. And our next article in this news section is entitled, "Maine Set to Pause Building Data Centers." Maine lawmakers passed a bill that temporarily halts the construction of data centers until November 2027, though it still needs Governor Janet Mills' approval. At least 11 states have introduced similar proposals. Debates about data centers are flaring across the country, from Oklahoma to Indiana to Pennsylvania. Power-hungry data centers are regularly blamed for rising electricity prices. That issue was central to November's gubernatorial elections in New Jersey and Virginia, the latter of which has the largest concentration of data centers in the country. An October analysis by the Bank of America Institute found that rising demand for power for data centers and manufacturing facilities is already leading to higher utility bills for residential customers, and it predicts the trend will continue as more data centers come online. Low-income households are disproportionately affected by higher utility rates, the analyst noted. Maine would be the first to enact a measure to pause data center construction. Supporters say it would allow time to study how data centers affect electricity costs. Maine has one of the highest electricity rates in the U.S. Opponents argue that the state already has strict rules in place and that new projects could help lower costs. And that was written by staff that don't identify. Hey, here's one more. Woman to coach German soccer club. For the first time in any of Europe's top soccer leagues, a woman will coach a men's team. Marie-Louise Etta is taking the reins of Union Berlin on an interim basis until the end of the season after the club fired its previous coach early in April. Ms. Etta already made history for Union in 2023 when she became the first female assistant for a men's team in any of Europe's top leagues. She is set to become the head coach of Union's women's team next season, but there is speculation that good results during the next month could put her in the frame for the permanent job. That was also written by people only identified as Steph. All right, now we have something called Graphic Explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is a full page with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 graphs on it. I'll try to explain these. And it's entitled America at 250, How the Population Has Changed. And this is written by Victoria Hoffman and Jacob Turcotte, who are staff employees. As the United States approaches its 250th anniversary, new research highlights how much America has changed since it celebrated its bicentennial in 1976. Those shifts appear in the country's demographic makeup, in the workplace, and in the economy, a March study from the Pew Research Center shows. The study mainly analyzed data from the decennial census dating back to 1970. Okay, here's the first one. Larger, more diverse, and older. The population has grown from about 218 million in 1976 to roughly 340 million, and it is much more diverse. Foreign-born populations have increased mainly among Hispanic and Asian communities. So here's this graph. The x-axis is years. It goes from 1970 to 2024. And the y-axis is population in millions. And the graph, the axis goes from 0 to 350 million. So back in 1970, the white population looks like about 165 million. Take that all the way out to 2024. Well, it peaked in about 2020 with not many more. And then it went back down to, I'm guessing here, about 175 million. The black population it's almost doubled in that time span from 1970 to 2024. I'm guessing it's somewhere under, looks like maybe 15 million. No, I'm sorry, 165 million. Back to 15 million, and it looks like it's about 25 million in 2024. Hispanic went from under 10 million to what looks like 50 million people between 1970 and 2024. And Asian went from barely perceivable in 1970 on the graph to approximately 10 million people in 2024. It says the population has aged significantly, with the number of people over age 65 doubling as baby boomers grow older. Birth rates have declined from an average of 3 children per woman to 2. People are getting married at a decreasing rate, and a larger portion of the population lives in multi-generational homes. This graph, again, goes from 1970 to 2024 on the x-axis, and on the y-axis it goes from 0 to 60%, and that is the percentage of population by age group. So ages 18 to 64 was approximately 55% of the people in 1970. It gradually went up, gradually, until 2024, it's about 60%. People who are under age 18 back in 1970 was about 35%, and it gradually went down to when you get to 2024, it's just about little over 20%. Age 65 or older, that's my category, in 1970 was around 10% of the population, and it gradually went up to the point where it is around 20% in 2024. Our next graph, the middle class has shrunk. The middle class, defined as adults whose income is double the nation's average, has shrunk, hinting at stagnation in the country's economy, Pew reported. Okay, middle-income people in 1970 were about 60% of the people, and by the time 2024 has come around, it's about 55%. Lower-income people in 1970 was, looks like, about 26%. And going all the way up to 2024, it gradually got up to a little over 30%. And upper-income people in 1970 was about 13 or 14%. And it gradually went up to 2024 when it was still in the upper teens, maybe 17%. And they don't define lower income or upper income, but I bet lower is below middle and middle is below upper. Hey, despite economic classes shifting, the percentage of Americans living in poverty has decreased from 14% to 11%. So again, the x-axis is 1970 to 2024, and the y-axis is percentage of Americans living in poverty. In 1970, it was at, as I said, 14%. By 1980, it was down to 12%, stayed that way until the early 90s, and by 2000, it dipped down to a little bit less. Then by 2010, it peaked back up to around 14%. And by before 2020, looks like the late teens, it leveled off at about 11%, and that's where it is at 2024. Women are a bigger part of the workforce, and Americans are more educated. The workforce has also changed significantly. Women's labor force participation has increased nearly 20 percentage points, while men's participation has decreased. So here's a graph. Again, the x-axis is 1970 to 2024, and the y-axis is 0 to 80%. And back in 1970, men were at, looks like upper 70-something percent, and gradually decreased till we get to 2024, and it looked like 70%. And female started at around 40%, and has gradually gone up to upper 50s%. And at the same time, the percentage of adults who have earned at least a bachelor's degree has increased by 26 percentage points, with 38% of degrees earned by women. So this is our last graph, and as you can expect, the x-axis goes from 1970 to 2024, and the y-axis goes to 0 to 40%, and that's the percentage of Americans age 25 or older with a bachelor's degree. So back in 1970, it was a little over 10%, and like they said in the text, by the time we got to 2024, it was 38%. Of the degrees earned by women. Look at that. And that is all with the graphs. All right, back to the news section in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. It's got the under the heading of Tel Aviv, Israel. In Lebanon, history gnaws at Israelis. Has military force alone brought security? The battle to disarm Hezbollah has revived an old debate in Israel about whether force without a political strategy risks open-ended conflict. This is written by Shoshana Solomon, who is a contributor. Avi Ashkenazi was a deputy battalion commander in Israel's 1982 war with Lebanon, fighting with his tank unit. When his commander was killed in action, Mr. Ashkenazi took over. That was when Israel, to push the Palestine Liberation Organization away from its northern border and halt years of PLO attacks on its northern residents, sent its forces all the way to Beirut. The war against Syrian army forces then occupying Lebanon and Palestinian guerrilla fighters enjoying Syria's protection lasted just 3 months, ending with the excavation of the PLO leadership from Lebanon at the cost to Israel of some 370 soldiers' lives. But Israel stayed for another 18 years, pulling back initially in 1985 to a security zone it established in the south. During that time, the Shiite Lebanese militia Hezbollah emerged, and another 700 Israeli soldiers were killed. Under intense domestic pressure over the mounting casualties, Israel finally withdrew in 2000. Now, as Israel once again sends forces into Lebanon to battle Iran-allied Hezbollah, the politicians discuss establishing a new security zone. Mr. Ashkenazi has a sense of deja vu. His nephew was fighting in Lebanon, and when they met briefly recently during a short visit home, they compared experiences. He told me they were in Yomor, a village some 5 kilometers, about 3 miles, from the Israeli border near the Litani River, Mr. Ashkenazi says by phone. What is sad is that 44 years ago, I was in the same village. The limits of force. Even as Iranian missiles fell on Israel before the U.S.-Iran ceasefire, the renewed battle against Hezbollah was shaping up to be a main focus of Israelis and was generating debate. Can military force in Lebanon deliver Israelis lasting security, or, as past experience suggests, does the absence of a clear political strategy risk drawing Israel back into a costly and open-ended conflict in what many call the Lebanese quagmire? Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that while he supported U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to suspend strikes against Iran to allow for negotiations, the 2-week ceasefire does not include Lebanon. The army then carried out the largest offensive against Hezbollah infrastructure of the war, targeting command centers and military sites in Beirut, the Bekpa Valley, and the south. Lebanon said more than 250 people were killed. The lessons we learned then have not been implemented, Mr. Ashkenazi says, of the 1982 war and its aftermath. We think that if we use force and more force, we will succeed. But in fact, force has not solved us any problems anywhere. What is needed is an agreement. In late 2024, after a punishing Israeli offensive capped more than a year of intensifying fighting with Hezbollah, Israel and Lebanon reached a ceasefire agreement under which the Beirut government pledged to disarm Hezbollah. Since then, Israel has continued near-daily strikes on Hezbollah targets. In March, after a weakened but defiant Hezbollah fired missiles and drones at Israel following the killing of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Israel responded with waves of airstrikes followed by a ground incursion into southern Lebanon. The stated aim, to remove the threat to northern communities in Israel, where tens of thousands of residents had only recently returned home after excavation during the war in Gaza, which Hezbollah joined in solidarity with Hamas. The army is completing the ground maneuver in order to protect and prevent a direct threat to Israeli border communities, Defense Minister Israel Katz said in early April, adding that disarming Hezbollah remains a top objective. Homes in Lebanese border villages used as Hezbollah outposts would be destroyed, he said, and Israel would maintain security control south of the Litani River. He also said the 600,000 Lebanese residents displaced from the south would not be allowed to return until northern Israel communities were secure. Yet the same day, a senior Israeli military official said fully disarming Hezbollah would be unrealistic without occupying all of Lebanon, something not under consideration. Need for diplomacy. The battle against Hezbollah has been going on for decades, and we're in a better position today because they were greatly weakened a year and a half ago, says Chuck Freilich, a former deputy national security advisor and a professor of political science at Tel Aviv University and Columbia University. Israel's strategy, he says, is to push Hezbollah roughly 10 kilometers from the border beyond the range of anti-tank missiles. The next step, he argues, should be diplomatic, working with Lebanon's government and international forces to disarm Hezbollah. These steps would require Israeli concessions, including a withdrawal of Israeli troops from southern Lebanon. Lebanon. This, he says, is a more winning strategy instead of just trying to endlessly hit targets that they rebuild afterwards. Indeed, Israeli and Lebanese envoys held U.S.-mediated talks in Washington April 14th to discuss the resumption of their ceasefire deal. The meeting was hailed as an important, if symbolic, first step. Maintaining a permanent security zone on Lebanese soil, as some political leaders have been calling for, Mr. Freilich warns, risks repeating past mistakes. Instead, Israel should operate from its own territory, carrying out targeted incursions when necessary. Meanwhile, the cost of the new incursion is rising. 13 Israeli soldiers had been killed as of mid-April as troops moved from village to village dismantling Hezbollah infrastructure. A major battle was being waged around a Hezbollah stronghold in the village of Blint Jabal. Some soldiers are also entering combat with reduced training. Ilet Heshahar Sadov, founder of the movement Mothers at the Front, says training has been shortened by several months. Our husbands and our fathers also were in Lebanon, she says. 2 years ago, our children were already in Lebanon, and we paid a price. It does not make sense that this has not brought us quiet. This means that those who are managing this war are managing it badly. At this point, she says, there is zero tolerance for the loss of Israeli soldiers' lives, especially as there is no faith in the government or Prime Minister Netanyahu, who in 2024 said Hezbollah had been set back decades. Low trust in government. A recent poll by the Institute of National Security Studies shows trust in the government remains low. Of those polled, 68% reported low confidence in the government, 46% say they believe Hezbollah can be disarmed, and 43% said they do not. After 4 soldiers from a reconnaissance unit were killed at the end of March, parents sent a letter to Mr. Netanyahu criticizing the extremely unreasonable conditions they were operating in. Exploiting the dedication of our children, young people who have already been fighting for 3 years, and then parentheses, 2 exclamation marks, in a tremendous war on all fronts, is a serious act of injustice that is unacceptable, they wrote. Gary Cohen, a writer and filmmaker who immigrated from Scotland and served as a paratrooper in the 1982 war, recalls landing deep inside Lebanon and fighting to Beirut. Friends were later killed during Israel's years in the security zone. We paid a heavy price, he says. Lebanon, he says, is one of the most beautiful places he's ever been to. I thought that one day I would bring my children on holiday and show them where we fought, he says. That was obviously a pipe dream, and it looks like my grandchildren will also fight in Lebanon. I would be a lot happier with what we're doing if I trusted the government, he adds. The government is very good at starting wars. It's got no idea or maybe no inclination to finish. Demand to finish the job. At the same time, many residents of Israel's north are demanding decisive action to finish the job in Lebanon. We were told that Hezbollah was weakened in a very significant way and we're going to have at least a few years of quiet, said Liat Cohen Rabib, who has lived on the border in Metula for 30 years. And that backfired on everyone. She recalls sitting in shelters as a child during the 1982 war. Today, her husband and 2 daughters are serving on reserve duty, while her son and nephew are fighting in Lebanon. Repeated cycles of conflict, she says, are not suitable. Hezbollah's long-range missiles now threaten all of Israel, not just the north, and everyone in Israel has an interest to solve this once and for all. Yet a solution should begin with policy, working with Lebanon's government, setting clear goals and timelines before relying on force, Ms. Rabib says. A renewed security zone, she warns, would turn Israeli soldiers into a living fence. Ofer Shila, a former member of parliament from a centrist party and now director of a national security program at the Institute of National Security Studies, says a security zone would again create favorable conditions for guerrilla warfare and would not stop rocket fire. But an election year, he notes, creates its own logic. Look at the political interests, both of the government and the military, he says. They will dictate a lot of what's going to happen, much more than very sound reasoning. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And our next article in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly is entitled The Twilight of Uganda's Tropical Glaciers. Glaciers in the tropics are rare and melting quickly, reshaping the lives of people who depend on them. This is written by Simon Vera, who is a contributor. From the Rwenzori Mountains in Uganda, Mountain guide, mountain tour guide Enoch Bramwell points at three sheets of ice lying between the ragged peaks of Mount Stanley on the border of Uganda and Congo. A towering glacier once stood here, he explains, but today this is all that's left. A constant splashing accompanies Mr. Bramwell's explanation as a nearby waterfall drains glacier meltwater at a high speed. During the dry season, some 5 million people in the foothills below depend on this water, but it is in increasingly short supply. Since the first measurements were taken in 1906, the Rwenzori Mountains, whose name means the place of snow in the local Lukanzo language, have lost more than 90% of their ice. Within a decade, experts predict it will be gone entirely. When Rwenzori's glaciers are far from the only ones under pressure, the world's glaciers are melting faster than ever before recorded. But the tropical glaciers that hug the equator and the Andes, Southeast Asia, and Africa are especially vulnerable. South America's glaciers are shrinking 35% faster than the global average, and a recent study of Indonesia's Eternity glaciers predicted they will be gone in 5 years. Meanwhile, the United Nations says that, according to available data, East Africa's glaciers will very likely be gone in 2050. For communities below these towering rivers of ice, their retreat is already reshaping life in ways both mundane and sublime. The taps guiding water to their communities from creeks has started to run dry part of the year, turning water collection into an hours-long journey. The Rwenzori glaciers are also believed to be the home of Kithasamba, a powerful deity responsible for the fertility of both the local Bakanzo people and their land. According to legend, when snow and ice disappears, their god disappears too. Even if individual glaciers have little effect on sea level rise, they are immensely important for local communities, says glaciologist Lander van Trijpt. Glaciers in the tropics. The glaciers on Mount Stanley form part of the Afro-Alpine Zone, an unusual ecosystem found at high altitudes in the African tropics. Here, giant ground cell, that's G-R-O-U-N-D-S-E-L, plants rise out of the ground like 20-foot-tall candelabras. They grow alongside tubular giant lobelias, whose drooping leaves provide shelter for the iridescent sunbirds that pollinate them. Plants and animals alike have adapted to the extremes of a climate often described as summer every day and winter every night. The glaciers that flow from the Afro-Alpine zone act as natural reservoirs for the communities below, storing water during wet, cold periods and releasing it in warm, dry ones. In those periods, people living downstream from the meltwater of Rwenzori's glaciers depend on it to bathe, drink, and take care of their livestock. Yosia Kibaya is a farmer in his mid-60s whose family has lived in the Rwenzori foothills for centuries. He grew up in a wide valley beside Nyamwamba River, about a 45-minute drive from the regional capital, Kasese. In the dry seasons, the Nyamwamba is fed by glacier meltwater, and in Mr. Kaibaya's memory, the river flowed year-round, wild and roaring. Now it is a meager trickle seeping between rocks in the dry season. "We don't even know those rocks were under the water back then," he said. Meanwhile, in the mountains surrounding his valley, there was snow every winter, he recalls, but he hasn't seen white caps for years. Nayesi Maseki, who lives on the banks of the same river, rattles off a list of the foods she once grew year-round. Sweet potatoes, pumpkins, tomatoes, yams. "Now I can only give my children plantains and beans for most of the year," she says. Ms. Maseki has 12 children, which is not uncommon here. In the last 50 years, the local constituency's population has grown almost eightfold, according to local officials, accentuating the impact of the dwindling water supply. A landscape drying out. Most people in these foothills have never seen the glaciers their livelihoods depend on. Between their villages and Mount Stanley's peaks, lies a vast mountain range of deep valleys and steep rock faces. Moss paints the rocks yellow, red, and green. Tough grasses grow from the mud, and towering lobelia flowers sway in the wind. For the untrained eye, this is an awe-inspiring landscape, but after 20 years guiding tourists in these mountains, Mr. Bwambwell notices something else. Dry clumps of moss crumble at the touch. Trees are dying of thirst, leaving behind leafless trunks. Every year I discover new creeks which have completely run dry, he says, walking through a waterless riverbed. The tourists he leads come here to climb the snow-covered peaks of the UNESCO World Heritage-listed Rwenzori Mountains. But those mountains are now facing a wide variety of challenges, including droughts, deforestation, and landslides. All of these environmental problems are amplified by the growing population. Meanwhile, residents and activists say they need help blunting the effects of the water loss. Some communities have begun planting trees to help the soil better hold moisture. Despite major international pledges in recent years to channel money to developing countries to mitigate the effects of climate change, people here say they have been left on their own. That leaves people like Edreen Bagambi, who is in her mid-20s, wondering what the future holds. When food runs out and the river dries out, I want to leave, she says, but where can I go? I don't have money to buy new land somewhere else. As Mr. Bwambwell descends from Mount Stanley, he speaks wistfully about the place he slowly sees disappearing. I no longer recognize the Rwenzori, he says. It hurts to know the next generation will never see the beauty I enjoyed for so long. The changing climate has far-reaching consequences for the Bakanzo. If the water shortage keeps increasing, we will have to leave, Mr. Bwambwell concludes as he descends through the tropical forest in the foothills. There's a note here. This article was published with the support of the Pascal Descruz Fund for Exceptional Journalism. And our next article in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly is entitled, Mass Departures from Congress Show Gridlock Frustration. Legislatures say fundraising and attention-getting are eroding norms of policymaking and consensus as the institution cedes its constitutional role. This is written by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer. From Washington, voters routinely give Congress rock-bottom approval ratings, saying the institution is unaccountable and ineffective. Some members of Congress would appear to agree. A near-record number of 68 lawmakers have said they will not run for re-election this cycle. Some are eyeing higher office, while others are leaving public service entirely. They're looking for a better life, quips Democratic Senator Peter Welch of Vermont. Lawmakers and voters alike have long complained that Congress has become an environment where legislating takes a backseat to fundraising, media appearances, and partisan battles. But experts say those trends are increasing so much that the institution is repelling policy-minded candidates who actually want to pass laws. It may not be the case that you're getting ordinary Americans shuffling through Congress, but you're instead getting a very small minority of people who may not be the ones willing to take on that wonky but important legislative work, says Ruth Bloch Rubin, an expert in American politics at the University of Chicago. Whether they're staying or going, many veteran lawmakers agree, as Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts puts it, that Congress is absolutely not the same as when she started serving in 2013. Senator Warren is running for re-election. The Monitor interviewed five retiring lawmakers and several others who have served for over a decade. Most say their work has been fulfilling, but they see increasing drawbacks. The constant pressure to fundraise is growing. They fear more than ever for their safety, and working across the aisle has become nearly impossible. A chorus of lawmakers also says Congress has ceded more and more of its power to the executive branch, a concern particularly of the party that is not in power. The institution's not doing the job that it's assigned to do, says Senator Welch. We all know it. Republicans echo that sentiment, with Nebraska Representative Don Bacon calling the political parties in Congress dysfunctional. Maryland Democrat Steny Hoyer, who is retiring after 45 years in the House, including over two decades in leadership, laments the loss of bipartisanship and says he's deeply concerned that the body is not fulfilling its duty under the Constitution. Public opinion polls show that most people think Congress might work better with term limits on members, but some experts say the fact that so many are leaving early highlights how the challenges in Congress, the difficulty of passing policy, and the institution's deference to the president means members who came to get things done are increasingly turning away frustrated. For some who are staying and for some would-be members running, legislating might not even be the priority. Congress is increasingly for those who are more interested in scoring political points on social media or on cable news than it is for people who want to try to make bipartisan deals, says David Barker, a professor of government at American University. It's just not built for that anymore. There doesn't seem to be a middle. Retiring Democratic Representative Julia Brownlee first got into politics when she ran for her local California school board to advocate for students like her daughter, who has dyslexia. After arriving on Capitol Hill in 2013, she used her position on the Veterans Affairs Committee to help pass bills like one expanding travel reimbursement for veterans seeking medical care with Republican support. She's still on that committee, but collaboration has waned. There doesn't seem to be a middle to work with, she says on a video call from her district office in Southern California. Since the 1970s, studies show Democrats in Congress have steadily grown more liberal, and Republicans have grown even more conservative. A realignment took place over decades as many conservative Southern Democrats became Republicans, and liberal Northeastern Republicans left the GOP. Partisan gerrymandering, when districts are redrawn to benefit a certain party or candidate, has further hollowed out the center. Republican Representative Michael McCaul of Texas, Chairman Emeritus of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said he joined a more respectful and collegial House 22 years ago. Back then, the retiring congressman says, working across the aisle was not a bad thing. The lack of bipartisanship has an effect. The 118th Congress, spanning 2023 to 2025, passed the fewest bills since the Civil War. President Trump's influence has sped up the exodus of moderate Republican members. Several, like North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis, belong to a tiny group of Republicans who have publicly criticized the president and his administration. Of 10 GOP House members who voted to impeach Mr. Trump in 2021, most are gone. Only one, California Representative David Valadao, is running for re-election. The other, Washington Representative Dan Newhouse, is retiring. The House and Senate leadership have deferred to the president, says Dr. Barker, so if you're a member who really just wants to make policy and wants to try to get stuff done, then you don't really get a lot of chances to do that. Not the schoolhouse rock process. Former Chairman McCaul has spent over two decades in the House after working in counterterrorism for the Texas State Attorney's Office. Reflecting on his time as a congressman during a phone call between votes and meetings, he said a major point of frustration has been working hard to get things passed in the House, only to see them go nowhere in the Senate. He's learned if you want to get something passed, you've got to attach it to a must-pass bill, like appropriations, he says. A 2024 study conducted by researchers at Pennsylvania State and Colorado State Universities found that as polarization rises in Congress, fewer bills get passed, but those that do tend to be more sweeping. Partisanship and slim majorities in the House and Senate mean it's often more effective for leadership to just put their priorities into special bills that need fewer votes to pass, or into must-pass bills like yearly funding packages. Congress has moved further and further away from following regular order in lawmaking, says Kevin Koser, a senior fellow at the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute. He cites, for example, the recent recurrence of government shutdowns when lawmakers can't agree on annual funding. Dr. Koser says the commonly understood schoolhouse rock process where a member introduces a standalone bill that makes its way through a committee and is voted on, is becoming more rare. Lawmakers must stay on leadership's good side, he says, hoping they can add their priorities into a massive spending package. It's very disempowering, says Dr. Kosar. A lot of members are just kind of shocked at how impotent they feel. This year, 12 members of Congress, 11 of whom are Republicans, are leaving to run for governor in their home states, in an executive office that allows for much more action and immediate results. Representative Ralph Norman, a Republican member of the conservative House Freedom Caucus, is running for South Carolina governor. He joined Congress in 2017 after working for his father's construction business and then serving in state government. During an interview at his office overlooking the Capitol, he says he regrets that he wasn't able to do more to reduce government spending. In his tall back chair, he leans away from the desk. A governor, he says, as governor, I can cut the budget. I'll have direct control. It shouldn't be that way. One challenge in particular has become far more acute in recent years. Members of Congress and prominent politicians across the country are facing a surge in threats. In 2025, Capitol Police investigated 14,938 cases of concerning statements, behaviors, and communications against members and their families. That's nearly a 60% increase from 2024. Event like last year's arson attack at Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's home and the deadly shooting of Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk highlight a growing culture of political violence that's causing some members, like Maine's Democratic Representative Jared Golden, who is leaving office in a swing district, to question whether the cost of their work is growing too high. As a father, I have to consider whether the good I can achieve outweighs everything my family endures as a result, he wrote. In the wake of Mr. Kirk's assassination, Congress voted to allot each member $10,000 per month to cover personal security costs, up from $5,000 previously. Representative Norman says he now has a security guard who accompanies him to town halls. It shouldn't be that way, but it is what it is, he says. You saw what happened to Charlie Kirk. That's just part of it now. Sound bites and cameras. Jonathan Lawallen, a professor at the University of Tampa, who has written about the decline of legislating in Congress, says a shift in the media environment has changed the way members think about their jobs. His research shows coverage of Congress has shifted more towards TV and radio and away from print, as many newspapers have closed. At the same time, social media has expanded and popularized quick sound bites. Dr. Llewellyn says this shapes the day-to-day business of Congress, as lawmakers focus more on issues they think the media will cover. Several members who have built a strong online presence during their time in Congress, like Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and former GOP Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, were never the primary sponsors of any bill that passed into law. And if that's the case, what's the point of being in Congress, asked Dr. Llewellyn. If you're just issuing press releases and giving speeches anyway, why not just have a podcast? In a changed Congress, who fits in? This year's turnover, which is tilted more towards Republicans, could help Democrats take control of the House and possibly the Senate. But it could also reshape Congress in other ways, bringing in a wave of different types of Republicans and Democrats. The ability to attract attention through social media tends to reward candidates who lean into controversy and conflict more than those who want to work across divisions on policy. Still, Dr. Kosar says a new class of members could make things better by refusing to treat having a majority as a winner-takes-all situation. You sometimes get these influxes of members who have broadly shared ideas about what's wrong with the way Congress is working, and they want to work to change things, he says. Given how miserable many now appear to be, he doesn't think it would take too many new voices to spur change. Democratic Senator Mark Warner, who is running again, says he values bipartisan wins he had earlier in his Senate career, which began in 2009. That spirit of bipartisanship feels gone, the Virginian says, but I think it's got to come back. Hey, here's something in the home forum section that I neglected to read last week. It's entitled Kids Space, a PBS preschool special celebrates the feeling of awe. The home forum has previewed an educational 22-minute special by the Jim Henson Company. Wows About, filmed in Sequoia National Park, stars new puppet characters. The special was created, written, and executive produced by Hale Stanford and principal puppeteer Dorian Davies. In Wows About, a friendship grows between Roxy, a hedgehog, and Ronald, a pig, as they're inspired by one of America's extraordinary natural wonders. Awe can be such a uniting force, and it's something we need a lot more of today, says Ms. Davis, who plays Roxy. Wows About will premiere May 1st and will be available for streaming. It will kick off the PBS Kids Across America initiative, running May through July. The initiative will showcase amazing places and real kids, as well as historic figures throughout the 50 states and U.S. territories. And finally, we got some statistics from the Numbers in the News column. 31, that's the percentage of Americans who were part of the upper middle class in 2024, up from 10% in 1979, according to a recent American Enterprise Institute report. The research classifies a family of three earning between $133,000 and $400,000 today as upper middle class. The findings show that the U.S. upper middle class is growing, while the lower middle class has shrunk over the past 50 years. And $258,030, that's the gap between the median net worth of white households, $276,900, and black households, $18,870, in New York State, according to a new racial equity plan released by New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani's office. Mayor Mamdani is attempting to expand his affordability agenda to include racial equality. And that was compiled by Audrey Thibert, who's a staff writer. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor Weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.